It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Jimmy Failla.
I'm Madison Allworth.
I'm Bill Hemmer, and this is the Fox News Rundown. Wednesday, April 12th, 2023. I'm Dave Anthony. It's a leak the U.S. has been trying to plug of classified documents detailing sensitive American intelligence.
There's a negative potential impact on our sources who are now questioning whether the super secret information that they're giving us at grave risk to themselves is worth it, because they don't want to get a bullet in the back of the head.
And Lisa Brady, a parental rights movement sows fertile ground for progress on school choice.
So this is a natural outgrowth of policies that are supporting family, empowering families and choices for kids.
And I'm Tommy Lahren. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Who's leaking American secrets? That's a big question in Washington, where senators want a classified briefing about classified documents found online detailing sensitive U.S. intelligence. Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace tells Fox,
"The administration literally has no answers. And so if they can't keep our top secrets safe, then how can they keep us safe? I mean, this is just another example of us projecting weakness."
The documents were first posted weeks ago on a gaming site, Discord, then spread other places.
Most appear to have come from a briefing book prepared daily for the Joint Chiefs and U.S. commanders overseas.
But Fox's Jennifer Griffin at the Pentagon also reports some of the leaks did not come from those books.
They appear to be produced by other U.S. intelligence agencies like the CIA and NSA. Some of the most damaging leaks have to do with South Korea, the United Arab Emirates, Israel, and Egypt. For instance, one of the more damaging documents concerns Egypt, which has received $50 billion in U.S. military aid since 1978. Reporting suggests President Sisi of Egypt planned to secretly ship 40,000 rockets to Russia for use in Ukraine at the same time that he was holding friendly phone calls with President Zelensky.
That is just one of the many bits of leaked U.S. intel related to the war in Ukraine. So who is doing this and why?
There are many more unanswered questions right now, of course, than there are answers.
Daniel Hoffman is a retired CIA senior clandestine services officer, now a Fox News contributor.
A few things that I would be concerned about. First of all, we don't know if this is the extent of the secret documents that have been stolen. Some have been disseminated, but there could yet be more. Secondly, there is no question that the motive behind stealing these documents was to hurt the United States of America. If we're wondering about it, this is clear weaponization of classified information. The possibilities are pretty, I would say, expansive in terms of who was responsible. It could have been a malicious insider like Snowden or Chelsea Manning. It could have been a non-state actor like Russia or China acting alone and stealing this information and then disseminating it. Or it could have been a combination of the two, where the Russians or Chinese recruited a source and then used that source to steal the documents. I don't think it was a non-state actor, a hacking group. There's no money to be made in this operation, just a lot of risk because you've got a bullseye on you from the U.S. government.
All right, well, you say hacking, but how else would China and Russia...
A hacking criminal group.
Okay.
Less likely.
Okay.
That it's just some criminal hacking group. I think much more likely that it's a state actor responsible for this. But I'm sure the Russians are enjoying the fact that this intelligence leak is being weaponized against the United States. And as you pointed out, some of the information that was leaked is certainly designed to drive a wedge between the United States and our key allies. That would be South Korea, Ukraine, obviously, Turkey, and Egypt.
Yeah.
And Israel. Those would be the key ones.
There's a report in the New York Times that Tuesday in South Korea, opposition lawmakers were angry because they say that these documents show that the U.S. has been spying on our ally. And we've learned supposedly about a lot of South Korean weapons being made and sent over to Ukraine. One other thing that came out of this story is that Defense Secretary Austin and the Defense Minister of South Korea supposedly agreed that quite a few of the documents in this leak were fabricated.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how much of this material is accurate?
Well, that's a question. So right now, let's start with that point, which is a really good one. Who might have had access to this information? What's been fabricated? The Russian modus operandi is to take something that's true, let's say 95% true, and then sprinkle their secret sauce of disinformation to design to influence thinking about a particular issue. And so it's certainly possible that that's what we're seeing in this case. The problem that we're having, though, with our allies is this is the kind of stuff you don't want to be exposed publicly. There, even if it's not true, it's going to have kind of a life of its own, a force multiplier where people will be reading this. And there's blowback politically on our allies. South Koreans have a law which prohibits them from providing military equipment which would be used in war. And what was alleged in those documents is that South Korea was shipping United States artillery and we were sending it on to Ukraine. So even if that's not true, and we know that there have been plenty of things out on the internet that aren't true, but that still have an impact, that's of concern to us. And the only way to get at it is to be transparent about our investigation and to be really forceful about putting the truth out there with an eye towards maybe drowning out the propaganda lies. But that's extremely challenging. The last point I'll make for you is the intelligence community, just like Department of Defense and our national security writ large, it's a zero-sum game. If I'm spending 20 hours a day on a task force designed to do the forensics and damage assessment from this secret document leak, I'm not doing other stuff. And if diplomatically we're talking about these secret documents and the impact they're going to have on our bilateral relationships with Egypt and Israel and others, I'm not doing other things that are important. And that's of grave concern to me as well.
One of the other things that comes out of all this is how we've been successful, supposedly, at infiltrating Russia's intelligence.
Look, we're really good at what we do. And that's what I did for a living, recruit spies and steal secrets. And we had a saying at the CIA, an old mentor of mine used to say, which was, the secret of our success is the secret of our success. And when something like this pops out into the open, that's just not very good for us because we don't do this for any public acclaim. We don't want any public acknowledgement of what we do. It should be in the shadows and in the background. And there's a negative potential impact on our sources who are now questioning whether the super secret information that they're giving us at grave risk to themselves is worth it because they don't want to get a bullet in the back of the head because Vladimir Putin is now reading intelligence that, you know, he has to wonder, well, where is it coming from? You know, and so the other question I would just, again, lots of questions to ask, but one is, were these documents leaked and were they altered after they were on the internet or were they stolen and then altered and then put out on the internet? I mean, these are additional questions that we must be asking. So look, there's a lot of work to be done on this. And at the end of the day, all we know for sure, it's a major counterintelligence flap for this administration. And President Biden should remember very well previous ones he had to deal with because it was during the Obama administration that they had to face Chelsea Manning and Snowden.
Dan is referencing two other massive security breaches. Chelsea Manning was an Army intelligence analyst who leaked classified military documents related to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and more. WikiLeaks posted it all online. Manning was convicted of espionage, theft, and aiding the enemy in 2013. But 4 years later, President Obama commuted her 35-year prison sentence, setting her free. 2013 was also the same year Edward Snowden leaked classified intelligence while working for the National Security Agency, the NSA, detailing widespread U.S. surveillance programs. He fled the country to avoid being charged. Russia gave him asylum and last year made Snowden a Russian citizen. So how do those massive breaches size up to this new one?
I don't think we know yet, and I would be very wary of speculating on just how bad these leaks are because they're probably not done yet. Maybe this is the first of a number of tranches. We just don't know.
So is this stuff coming from the CIA, from the Defense Department, all of the above, anywhere else? Where is it all coming from?
Right. And that it may be coming from all of those places. And that's another thing that I expect our task force will be looking at, exactly where the information came from. And also just important to bifurcate what looks like it's accurate, what is accurate and what isn't. So look, like I said, it's early days on this, very early days. We have to be careful about speculating too much about how this compares to other breaches. But, you know, once we have more information about exactly what was stolen, then I think we'll feel like we can start to make some of those conclusions. But look, as you could, you rightly note, this is a major issue for us, and it's going to take a lot of the oxygen out of our relationships with important allies at a crucial time. And it's going to take a lot of man and woman hours out of our intelligence community to try to do the forensics and the damage assessment.
I mean, you can shut down like the Discord server and you can stop that. But how do you, since you don't exactly know yet the source of all this, how do you stop this leak? Can you?
I don't think you can. If you think about the numbers of people who would have had access to this intelligence, and I'm sure someone has already looked at that, it's like looking for a needle in a stack of needles. Really hard to do it. And that's also extremely time consuming to do this kind of work. It's typically we catch spies because another spy told us who the spy is. That's how we got Rick Ames. That's how we got Hansen and others. In this case, you know, we learned about this because we found it on the internet, not because some foreign spy told us that we have a spy in our own midst. And that just makes it extraordinarily difficult. But I can tell you from my experience that the sources with whom I had the honor of working all over the world took extraordinary risks on behalf of U.S. national security to protect U.S. citizens. And there was nothing that was more important to us as CIA officers than protecting those people, our sources. And that's why when something like this happens, it really can have a very significantly negative impact on the calculus that an individual might make before they agree to be one of our sources. That's the concern that I would have.
So the people who do the jobs now that you used to do are what? Extremely nervous, worried, upset, angry? What are they?
Leaving the emotional side out of it, because, you know, you don't really, my experience is I just don't want to waste my time on that. I'm going to work the problem, and I'm going to meet my source, and I'm going to make sure that I button down the tradecraft so that I'm running my source as securely as I possibly can. It's up to the individual CIA case officer out there in the field, on the front lines, many behind enemy lines in harm's way, to do everything they can to protect the sources that we have and reassure them that we're doing that. And then when they go out to recruit new sources, to reassure those new sources that we can protect them. But our job got a lot more difficult because of a leak back home. And yes, that's, I'm sure there were a few expletives in far flung places all over the world before they got back to work.
Daniel Hoffman, retired CIA senior clandestine services officer and a Fox News contributor. Thanks very much for joining us.
All right.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
This is Tommy Lahren with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Universal school choice programs are springing up around the country.
State of Florida is number one when it comes to education freedom and education choice.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recently signing a bill that expands the state's existing program, dropping restrictions, including income limits, to make all students eligible.
The largest expansion of education choice, not only in the history of this state, but in the history of these United States. That is a big deal.
The Florida Teachers Union says the program will take billions of dollars away from already underfunded classrooms, accusing the governor of putting political ambition ahead of Florida's families. Supporters say it's a revolution to fund students, not systems, with several states passing universal choice so far this year.
It certainly has a lot of momentum now, and it's thrilling to see.
Former U.S. Education Secretary military and longtime school choice advocate, Betsy DeVos.
After toiling in the fields for 35 years, on behalf of policies like this that we're seeing states now adopt really across the country, it's very exciting to see. And it's really, in my view, the beginning of an exciting phase for K-12 education experiences.
What's driving these latest school choice programs? I mean, was lockdown the tipping point?
I think when parents had a front row seat to see exactly what was going on and what was happening or what wasn't happening in their children's schools during the distance learning or whatever iteration of observation of COVID a family had, it really was revealing to so many families who before thought their kids were doing just fine in a school they probably chose to live in that particular district for. And it really did spur the momentum and the numbers around families who were ultimately unsatisfied with what they saw.
Let's break down one of the newest expansions of school choice signed into law by Florida's governor, because I know funding is always a concern with programs like this. Florida's new law envisions the money following the student, but doesn't say exactly what it could cost or where all of the money will come from. The basic model, though, you know, seems to be a family opting for choice gets their district's share of per student funding for that student. Do I have that right? And is that sustainable?
Yes. Generally speaking, when we're talking about universal education savings accounts, most of the states that have joined that bandwagon in the last several months or year are doing so with the funding levels that are approximately 90% of what the state spends on that child already. So instead of the state paying for that child to go to their assigned district school, that money goes with that child and that family to choose the place that's going to work best for him or her. So this is a natural outgrowth of policies that are supporting family, empowering families and choices for kids.
One of the criticisms of that, though, is that as it focuses, you know, more on individual students and empowers families, it also takes money away from the public school because of that shift. You know, what about that criticism? I mean, is that a legitimate concern?
Well, if the investment is in the child and the child is no longer in that school, then the school doesn't have responsibility for that child's education. And this has really been an important continued learning. And there have been many studies done on the Florida situation. And it's very telling to note that in the districts where the greatest percentage of students are going to schools other than their assigned district school, whatever that choice might be, the achievement levels for the students within that district have all actually continued to improve. And I believe it's because the schools are making adjustments and making changes that they wouldn't before when they didn't have anything or anyone else to compare themselves to. So it's a win-win for every student, no matter where they are.
I was going to ask you where magnet and charter schools fit into the choice picture, because they're actually run by public schools, right? So if you have this education account or a voucher, it wouldn't be used toward tuition, correct?
Well, let's distinguish between a magnet school. A magnet school is a school within a district that is often focused on one specific area of study or interest. So it might be theater and the arts, for example, or it might be STEM focused. But it is a part of the district system and run by the district. And the thing with magnet schools is that the schools are permitted to screen for students that are appropriate for that school. So if they have an academic hurdle to go over, they can test students and they can take in children who they deem prepared for whatever they have to offer. A charter school, by contrast, is also a public school, but it's run independent from the school district.
So when we talk about
school choice and the funding that families have access to, is it mainly for tuition at things like private schools, or can it also be used for instructional materials if you're not using it for a private school, for instance? You know, what, or does it vary by state?
It really can be used to customize any child's education. So let's say for a child in Florida, they are in a small town high school that has a nice, you know, round of offerings for, you know, types of classes, but that it doesn't have perhaps two or three of the subject areas. Maybe there's a language the student wants or needs, or a particular science class, or something that the school can't offer. This student can take the education savings account and apply, you know, a bulk of it toward the school that he or she already attends, and then take some of it to perhaps buy an online course taught by a really great professor on the other side of the world.
I was surprised to read, actually, how many states allow online learning options as part of the curriculum. And I don't mean homeschooling necessarily, just the kind of creative things that you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there are many great online platforms and providers, and, you know, many families actually migrated to those during all of the lockdowns and shutdowns because they, you know, they saw in many cases very high quality options that they, you know, and they ended up seeing how well they worked for some kids. Now, that's not for every child. Just like sitting, you know, lined up in rows of desks in a classroom isn't the best environment for every child to learn. So it really does center our focus of education, what education actually should be, learning and preparing to become, you know, contributing members of society. It focuses it around where it should be, the student, and helping him or her really develop their innate talents and gifts to the fullest extent.
I did want to ask you about one of the other criticisms that tends to come up about school choice programs, and that's the argument that wealthier parents already paying for a private school, for instance, don't necessarily need this help.
And I think that's largely the case, but I think that the states that are passing universal programs recognize and acknowledge that this option and this opportunity should be there for every child in that state. And I suspect that the highest percentage of families who will opt into and use these education savings account programs will be lower income families and many middle to, you know, upper middle income families. Again, I think it's going to foster creativity around education experiences that we haven't even really begun to dream about, because we've been so used to education for K-12 students being provided largely the same way for 175 years.
Is there a way to offer school choice but still lift up and improve public schools at the same time? I mean, it sounds like you're, you know, pretty much saying that that's actually a byproduct of school choice, is lifting up the public schools.
Yes, it is, absolutely. And again, I refer to Florida, that has done, you know, there's been a number of longitudinal studies done about the impact that education freedom programs have had here. And let me just interject here. I like to use the term education freedom versus school choice, because I think it helps us think more broadly beyond specific buildings to a much more holistic approach to what education can look like for every child. It gets beyond, you know, school building walls. But what we've seen in Florida is where those students are in districts that have a higher percentage of kids choosing a school other than their assigned district school, all of the kids' achievement levels have continued to go up. And I think that's only going to accelerate from here as more families take this opportunity to really examine what is going to work best for each of their children.
Nearly 40 years of advocacy. I'm sure you've heard it all, the praise and the complaints. How has this issue evolved? You know, what do families who utilize education freedom programs tell you about the decisions they've made and how it's impacted their kids?
It has been so inspiring. Anytime I feel in any way discouraged, all I need to do is pick up the phone or see, you know, face to face any one of a number of individuals that I've gotten to know over the years whose lives literally have changed because their families had the opportunity to access one of these very early small programs. And states across the country are now recognizing how important it is for families to have that empowerment and for kids to be able to find their right fit.
More than 30 states have some version of school choice now. Are you optimistic about the rest?
I am ultimately. This is very quickly going to be also become an economic competitiveness issue. Because when businesses today are trying to attract new, younger workers to whatever they have to offer in terms of a job, the first thing that a young family does is check the quality of the academic offerings in any city or state or town. And those states that continue to be tied to the government-run school union benefactors are going to continue to fall further and further behind as a result.
Former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Lisa. Great talking with you.
And in other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. The Bronze Age featured a number of advancements: irrigation, the invention of the wheel, and now tripping on hallucinogens. 3,000-year-old locks of hair that likely belonged to shamans were discovered in a burial chamber in the Mediterranean island of Menorca, which belongs to Spain. They tested positive for a number of mind-altering compounds, suggesting the people who lived there incorporated hallucinogenic experiences into their rituals. The findings, published in the scientific reports of the journal Nature, suggest the first direct evidence of ancient European hallucinogen use. Researchers say the drugs were consumed over the period of a year and well before death. Although there's no way to know why those ancient people were consuming such powerful drugs, the lead researcher notes the tubes in which the hair were found were decorated with concentric circles, which researchers say may represent the inner vision shamans experienced after ingesting hallucinogenic plants. But they also say there's still a lot they need to learn. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
New from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for season 3 of my limited time podcast, Everything Will Be Okay, based on my best-selling book of the same name. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tommy Lahren.
What's on your mind?
Welcome to the rainbow era, where women of all shapes, sizes, and races are being replaced by white men, and all the while the feminists keep quiet or cheer it on. There's no bigger cheerleader than the Biden administration, which recently released new guidelines to make it easier for men to dress up as women and run roughshod over what used to be women's-only categories. New Title IX regulations would essentially make it more difficult for schools and colleges to keep bio males out of women's sports. Under these new rules, no school or college that receives federal funding would be allowed to impose a one-size-fits-all policy that categorically bans transgender students from playing on sports teams consistent with their gender identity. If so, that institution would be in violation of Title IX. Title IX was put in place 50 years ago to further women's rights and opportunities, but it's been put through the shredder, and the party that supposedly fights for women is leading the charge. Conservatives are the new feminists. Bet you didn't see that one coming. I'm Tommy Lahren, and you can watch my show, Tommy Lahren is Fearless, at Outkick.com.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Hey, it's Will Cain, co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend. Join me as I share my thoughts on a wide range of topics, from sports and pop culture to politics and business.
The Will Cain Podcast. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.